Pesach is the Exodus of Egypt, throughout is the giving of the Torah, etc. But the Torah also describes them as part of an agricultural cycle. That Pesach is the beginning of the spring, so after the long dormant winter, the grain begins to ripen. Shavuot is already a time of harvest, and Sukkot is when we bring in the fruits of the field after a whole summer of drying out in the field. So Sukkot is the holiday of ingathering. So if you connect it to Pesach and Shavuot, it's connected to the agricultural cycle. Now, what is the significance of a holiday commemorating the agricultural cycle? Again, there are different ways of looking at it. It's gratitude for the harvest, etc. But many of the commentaries adopt the idea that particularly at the time of ingathering, when a human being is very satisfied, he sees the fruit of his labor, there is always the danger of arrogance, there is always the danger of pride, there is always the danger of forgetting those who are less fortunate than you as you enjoy the bounty of your harvest. And therefore, as an antidote to the arrogance that is connected with the ingathering and the produce, God says, go out and recognize the precariousness of your existence. Go out and expose yourself to the elements. Recognize how much you need HaKadosh Baruch Hu, how helpless you are. That all of the blessings that one achieves is not because of their own skill or their own cunning or their own endowment, but it's because of God's grace and God's mercies to us. And as a result, therefore, by exposing yourself to the elements, that's why the halacha is that the sukkah has to be able to let in the rain. You don't sit in the sukkah when it rains, but basically the concept is, because if your sukkah is too much like a house, you're not really fulfilling the entire mitzvah. Because part of sukkah is vulnerability, dependence, and precariousness. And that is the attitude to the arrogance and complacency that could affect us. In effect, the imagery here is that in the sukkah, we all become a little bit homeless. We all kind of lose our normal bearings. That's why, in a way, keep in mind that we don't really do it the right way. You know, we kind of have our meals, then we go inside. But I mean, the authentic way of a sukkah is, this is your home for 7 days. One, you know, should sleep in the sukkah, ideally, although we have various, you know, leniencies because of climate and safety and the like. But for example, many, many Jews, even in the United States, sleep in the sukkah. And of course, if you go to Israel, where the climate is a little better, virtually, you know, most of the Orthodox Jews in Israel do sleep in a sukkah. A sukkah is supposed to be a home, but the concept is it recognizes our helplessness, our dependency on God, and that in turn allows us to identify with those who are less fortunate, because we also experience kind of what it means to be impoverished and bereft of material possessions. That is the linkage to the agricultural cycle, and that is the booth, the imagery of the actual flimsy, ephemeral booth. But the other idea of the clouds of glory connects Sukkot to Yom Kippur. And that is, it's part of the Chagei Tishrei. And that is, that when a human being is finally liberated from the albatross of the past, when God cleans our souls and allows us to move forward, there's a tremendous amount of joy and serenity in that. That the joy of Sukkot, and by the way, as you know, of all the holidays, although there's a mitzvah to rejoice on all of the holidays, it is only Sukkot that is specifically called Zaman Simchatenu, the season of our joy. It is the greatest of the joy. In a physical sense, the ingathering, but in a spiritual sense, the real joy of Sukkot is the aftermath of Yom Kippur. That what greater gift could there be for a human being that we're able to start our lives anew, to rebuild, to go on, not to be a victim or a hostage to whatever we may have done in the past. It's like a great stone is lifted off a person's heart, and they're able to begin with reconciliation and forgiveness. And therefore, the imagery of the protective embrace of God is really much more connected, perhaps, one might say, to the aspect of Sukkot in the aftermath of Yom Kippur, rather than the agricultural cycle. In other words, there are two things going on at the same time. One is the agricultural cycle and the antidote to the arrogance that we might have. The other is the joy of being embraced by God in the aftermath of Yom Kippur. It's also said in many, many books, in particular Hasidic books, that the sukkah is designed to kind of be the transition between the ethereal spirituality of Yom Kippur and the demands of everyday life. Because it's very, very hard to go
from the apex of Kedusha that one achieves to Yom Kippur to the hustle and bustle of everyday life. We need a way station. We need a transition. We need a way to integrate the holiness of Yom Kippur into the demands of real life. And Sukkot is said to be that particular method of transition. So although people say, gee, too many holidays in Tishrei, everything is front-loaded, right? Why can't we, you know, distribute it a little more evenly, right? Let's have something in Tishrei, you know, et cetera. But everything is front-loaded. But part of the idea is, because if one would go from Yom Kippur to everyday life, the lessons of Yom Kippur would be dissipated and forgotten. You need specific holy experiences in the real world, building, you know, nailing the nail, etc., in which you take the Yom Kippur lessons and you apply them in real life, and therefore that gives you kind of a roadmap to how to sanctify the year as well. So, again, just interesting to think about that, the Sukkot really has two different dimensions. It's part of the agricultural cycle of the Shalosh Regalim, but it's also connected to the holiness of Yom Kippur as a transition to bring it into our daily lives. And of course, we know that Baal Shem Tov used to say that he loved the Sukkah because every part of him could enter the Sukkah, even the mud on his boots. So the concept is that's the unconditional love that God has for us, that every part of us goes into the Sukkah. In fact, the Vilna Gaon, interesting, the Baal Shem Tov and the Vilna Gaon were actually great antagonists. The Vilna Gaon was very much against the Hasidic movement, but the Vilna Gaon said a similar, very similar thought. In fact, it's very striking, in spite of all this machloket that we had between the Baal Shem Tov and the Vilna Gaon, it's funny, you can find parallel stories. It's almost as if there's a Hasidic version of a story and a Mitnagdic version of a story. It's the same story. And the Vilna Gaon said a very, very similar remark. The Vilna Gaon said, there are only two mitzvot that you do with every single part of your body. And that is living in the land of Israel and going into Sukkah. Because there, every little part, you know, your big toe is doing that mitzvah as well, because you're totally enveloped in the Sukkah. So it's especially a very, very joyous time, and, you know, it's something to really to look forward to, that we come to this holiday in a state of great, great purity. Of course, we can lose it fairly quickly, you know. It's very interesting. The first Shemona Esrei, right after Yom Kippur, we do the daily evening service, right after Yom Kippur. And in that first Amidah, right after Yom Kippur, we already ask God to forgive us for our sins. So one might ask, gee, I haven't gone home yet, I haven't eaten yet, I haven't done anything yet. What particular sin could I have committed? All right, so the truth of the matter is, unfortunately, we can go wrong right away. But there is a thought that says, the great sin is if a person perhaps believes they have not been totally forgiven. If a person leaves Yom Kippur without a sense of forgiveness, you have to ask God forgiveness for that. But that itself is a big hit, right? So that's just something to think about as we enter Sukkot. Okay, having said that, though, therefore, it's very, very important that just re-emphasizes what we said, that the idea of tshuva should not die after Yom Kippur. But if anything, now that we've talked about the past, we now, you know, make concrete resolutions for the future. So last week, we looked at the Chovat HaLevavot, and we'll be looking at more passages from the Chovat HaLevavot. Again, a very early work, a work that was prior to Maimonides, and consequently Chovat does not quote other, you know, rabbinic sources, but it's a work, and again, unfortunately, Chovat HaLevavot is beset with translation problems. Let me tell you why. Not only is the English translation not particularly good, but the Hebrew translation is not particularly good, meaning to say that the Chovat HaLevavot is written in Arabic, and it was translated by actually a very, very famous family of translators, the Ibn Tibbon family, which also translated Maimonides' works. But the problem there was, again, I don't know Arabic, so I can't speak to it precisely, but the problem there was that they were overly literal with regard to Arabic sentence structure. That's always a problem that translators have, because the sequence and the syntax of different languages have different word orders. And consequently, if you do a word-for-word literal translation of any language, it's going to be very, very awkward. And consequently, the Ibn Tibbon translation is also very, very difficult. So the English is a second-level translation. There have been more recent Hebrew translations, and there are also some new English translations, which I think are actually made, though, from the old old Hebrew translation. So it's something to be aware of. But again, the Chovet HaLevavot is a difficult book. Just to summarize a few points, again, some of this we mentioned last week, of the central message there, that remember that the Chovet HaLevavot enumerates four basic elements in what Shuvah requires. He says there must be charata. Charata is regrets and remorse. There must be what is called azivat hachet, which means you must forsake the activity. You can't do tshuva while you're still doing the sin, so to speak. There must be vidui ubakashat mechila. He combines that. Vidui is verbal articulation of confession and asking God for forgiveness. And the fourth must there must involve kabbalah ala atid, which means there must be resolution. There must be some concrete strategy in your mind, how you're not going to try not to repeat those particular ideas. And the Chovet HaLevavot mentions many, many other things. He mentions the idea of going to the other extreme, that if one was doing something wrong, one does not simply cease from the Aveira, but one goes to the other extreme. Again, an idea that Maimonides develops as well. He talks about senses of shame, he talks about crying, emotional expression, mourning, shvirat halev, the breaking of the heart. Again, it comes up very much. As you can see, the Chovet HaLevavot is a very internally directed book, meaning he focuses much not only on behaviors, but on emotional, internal life as well. And then he discusses various other questions. The Baal Tshuva, who is greater? The Baal Tshuva, the one who sins but does Tshuva, or the one who never sinned at all? And he discusses, he says that on some level, he makes a very interesting point. He says on some level, not in every respect, but on some level, the Baal Tshuva is greater than the Tzaddik who never sinned at all. That's a quote from the Talmud, but he offers a very interesting explanation. He says, and the explanation is, because the greatest problem that Tzaddik faces is the problem of arrogance and pride. Pride in his self-righteousness. The Baal Tshuva that has fallen and knows that mankind is prone to failure is saved from that sin of arrogance. Now that's actually a unique interpretation. The Talmud already makes the point, that was not his invention, the Talmud already makes the point that the place where the Baal Tshuva stands is even greater than the place of the perfectly righteous. But the Talmud does not exactly explain why. And there are different reasons that are given for that. One reason is because the Baal Tshuva has to struggle, meaning the Baal Tshuva, who has a temptation and a desire for all sorts of these things, every time he walks by, he is struggling. And God respects the struggle more than the person doesn't have to struggle. That's Maimonides' interpretation. But the Chovet HaLevavot offers an interpretation of his own, and he says the tzaddik is more prone to pride and arrogance. Of course, you know, it's very interesting. A later work, the Mesilat Yesharim, the Path of the Just by Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzata, actually talks a lot about humility and modesty, and he talks about this phenomenon. He talks about the phenomenon of what might be called false modesty, in which a person is proud of how modest and humble they are. So a person kind of makes a point of always sitting in the last row, you know, always, you know, walking with his head down because he's so humble. And in his heart of hearts, he gets a tremendous amount of pride. I'm such a humble person. But, you know, they tell the story that there was a man who was once davening very fervently on Yom Kippur. And when the Chazan says, Adam Yisodo Me'afar, a man, what is man who comes from the dust, right? It's the whole passage. And he is like a driven leaf, and you know, he has, you know, no worth at all. And the man was sobbing and crying and beseeching, and the rabbi was very, very impressed. The rabbi said, "Gee, this is my, I never knew this person was such a righteous man, such a pious man." And the rabbi wanted to pray next to him because he wanted to be inspired by how fervent his prayers were. Anyway, it was then mincha time, and the one who gets to read the haftorah of the book of Yonah, that's a very big honor. And apparently this man was expecting to get the honor. I guess they weren't auctioning it there. And somebody else got the honor. So the man started yelling. He says, "How dare you give it to him? I'm obviously the most qualified person." So the rabbi went over to him after Yom Kippur and said, "You know, I noticed that during the Musaf, And when we're talking about how insignificant man is, how worthless he is, how lowly he is, you were crying with all your heart that you really believed this. So how could you, you know, now talk about the honors that you felt were coming to you? So the man said to the rabbi, he says, what are you bothering me? When I'm talking to God, I know I'm nothing. But compared to him, you know, I'm a lot better than him. You know, so it's that, yeah. Yeah.
A book that just came out on the subject, which I read quite fascinating, is called Paper of Nagin, that addressed to Clark Allen Nadler, the author, addressed by the precise areas where those conflicts took place. And it was a surprise to me, but one of the issues that arose was that Nagin believed that a scholar should be proud of his scholarship, that it was false modesty to not do so, and that it was a dishonor to the scholar to take anything less than the honors that should be granted to him. Whereas there was a belief among the Hasidim that the Rebbe had also, there are many stories that we know, some of the Hasidic tales about the Rebbe taking the more modest position and in some areas at least reducing himself, lowering himself to the level of the people to be able to reach them. And this was one of the, there's a number of other more specific disputes.
Yeah, well, again, I think, actually, I'm familiar, not with that book, although that sounds like a very interesting book, but Rabbi Nadler has had a really long opposition to Hasidus, although it's interesting that. But I would have to say that particular point, I think, is overstated, meaning, if you go back to the Talmud, for example, and go back to the Chumash itself, Moses is praised, you know, for his humility. And certainly in the Talmud and the Midrash, we have many, many statements about the importance of humility, humbleness, to walk humbly with God, the person, Micha. Now, where there is, however, a countervailing idea is, there is a concept called Kavod HaTorah, in which the Talmid Chacham is somehow supposed to differentiate between honor that is due to him as an individual and honor that is due to God's Torah. So indeed, there is a whole system of law in which one is supposed to honor the Talmid Chacham, and to some degree, the Talmid Chacham is not supposed to tell people, don't give me any of these honors, because there's a concept of honor of the Torah, but it's not supposed to be a personal honor. It's honor to God's Torah. Now, what happened was, and this is what one of the evils the Baal Shem Tov was trying to address, is that indeed there were some learned people, as there would be at any time, who as a result had a certain arrogance and looking down at others, and the Hasidic movement to some degree in its early years went to the other extreme to create an atmosphere of equality and egalitarianism. But as always is the case, you try to combat one extreme with going to another extreme, which in turn elicited the wrath of people like the Gaon of Vilna. Now, the Gaon of Vilna was personally a very humble person, but the Gaon of Vilna felt very, very strongly that those who learn Torah should be accorded high respect, etc. So that's where you get that tension. The truth, as is always the case, is ultimately in the middle, but they were veering back and forth in that particular way.
Maybe the reason that the Baal Teshuvah, as against the Tzaddik, maybe there was this subtle hint that they gave you that it's impossible to be a complete Tzaddik. Mm-hmm. Even a Tzaddik is going to inadvertently do something.
Right.
So the fact is that there could not be a complete Tzaddik, and if someone thinks that they are, then maybe they ought to know that the Baal Teshuvah is valuable.
Right.
Like a subtle hint.
That's a very good point, meaning no one should think they are a perfect Tzaddik. That reminds me of a famous story. This past year, I was involved in teaching in a place called Or Samer. It was a very well-known yeshiva in Jerusalem for people who come to Judaism at a later age, for Baalei Tshuva. And they tell a famous story that a boy, once in a while we get a student who had been an FFB, we call them, from birth, the Orthodox. So the story was told that he went to a great Hasidic Rebbe, the Ger Rebbe, and he said that he studies in Or Samer, but he hastened to add, but I'm not a Baal Tshuva. So the Gerei Rebbe looked at him and said, why aren't you? Are you perfect? What do you mean you're not a Baal Tshuva? So we make an artificial distinction when we say a Baal Tshuva, somebody, didn't keep Shabbat, now keep Shabbat. Every one of us, we have to be a Baal Tshuva. If we lost our temper, if we're not as considerate to our parents or our children, right? A person who's not a Baal Tshuva, right? He must think he's perfect. The person is obviously delusional under those circumstances. So you're correct. The concept of Tzaddik, Baal Tshuva, is really an artificial, it's not a realistic distinction in many ways, because every person must be a Baal Teshuva.
It's a subtle hint, though.
It could be, because indeed he makes the point. But this is a little bit, this is his own chidush, this is his own interpretation, that the greatness of the Baal Teshuva is the Baal Teshuva is not prone to the arrogance that a tzaddik might be prone to. You know, they tell a similar story about the notion of the hypocrisy of false modesty, about, it's probably an apocryphal story, but it's a very, very cute story, about two yeshiva boys were going home for the holidays, it was before Rosh Hashanah, and they were discussing, you know, their flaws and their inadequacies in the eyes of God, and they were saying, I am nothing, you know, I don't daven correctly, I don't learn, I don't do the mitzvot, I need God's forgiveness. And the other boy says, oh, you think, you know, you're bad, you know, I'm worse, I have so many aveirot, I must repent. So in back of them was sitting a very simple Jew who was not very educated, and he sees these two learned people who are berating themselves, so he gets very aroused, and he says, oh my God, and he starts crying louder than both of them, he says, my God, you know, I don't even study the Torah. So the boys got very upset. They turned around and said, look who thinks he's nothing, you know. He doesn't have a right to say he's nothing. You know, he's not pious enough. You know, so there, that's what the Mesilat Yesharim deals with, the idea of taking pride in your humility. The Baal Teshuva, who has failed in life, and this is really a lesson generally, because failure can take many forms, spiritual failure, but failures in life does teach us humility. Teach us not to be arrogant. Teach us not to take life for granted. And as a result, there's a certain spiritual quality that a Baal Teshuva can possess that might not be possessed by the person who has never failed. And in fact, it's very, very fascinating that this thought is developed. Again, Chovot HaLevavot is a very early book, right? But this thought is developed really in many, many later works. And I'll just give you a thought where this thought is articulated. And it explains the concept of why the malchut, why the kingship of the Jewish people was given to the Davidic line. Because the truth of the matter is, if you look at the book of Genesis, a logical candidate for malchut would have been Yosef. Right? Yosef comes to Egypt. Yosef takes care of his brothers. Yosef takes care of the Jewish people, etc. That's malchut. So one would have assumed when the Jewish people later established a monarchy, the monarchy should come from Yosef, which would be the tribe of Ephraim or Manasseh. Now, in truth, the kings of the 10 tribes, which were the breakaway, did in fact come from, usually, Ephraim or Manasseh. But nevertheless, the ultimate Malchut, and of course the line of Mashiach, does not come from Yosef, although there is, in mystical writings, a reference to a Mashiach, the son of Yosef, who is supposed to be killed before there's a Mashiach ben David. In fact, this is the funniest thing. I just read about the Shabtai Tzvi, you know, the false Mashiach, that when he was proclaiming himself Mashiach ben David, so he was visited by a great... You just get this idea of two crazy people sitting around the table, because he was visited by a very, very great Kabbalist, Nechemiah, Rav Nechemiah HaKohen from Poland. And Rav Nechemiah HaKohen started saying, well, how could you be Mashiach ben David? Mashiach ben Yosef hasn't accomplished his mission yet. So Shabtai Tzvi proved from many Kabbalistic sources that Mashiach ben Yosef was an idea, was not a person. So this Kabbalist said, that can't be. I'm Mashiach ben Yosef. I haven't done my job. You know, so like this. I mean, it's nothing to laugh about, because unfortunately this was a very tragic episode that involved hundreds of thousands of people. But that particular scene just struck me as, you know, just sitting and having this insane, two insane people. And largely they were insane. Shabtai Tzvi was a very gifted person. He basically was schizophrenic and manic depressive, and he really was a psychological condition. But just to strike me as like the craziest thing. But anyway, but be this it may, it is brought down that the reason why Malchut comes to David HaMelech is based on the notion that a person cannot be a melech unless there is a kupa shel shuratzim, which literally means a bag of worms dragging behind him. The modern expression would be skeletons in your closet. A melech should have skeletons in his closet. When Yosef is confronted with sexual temptation, Yosef just says no. Yehuda, who is David's forebear, as you know, he succumbs to Tamar. David had his own problems. But there is a concept here that a melech must really be a Baal Tshuva more than a Tzaddik Gamur. And part of the idea is, there are two ideas here. One is so that the Melech should have humility and submission before God, which is the Chovat HaLevavot idea. And the other is a different idea, that a Melech should be a spiritual role model to us. You know, there's always a problem when we have role models who are too perfect. We cannot really identify. We need someone who shows us that even when we fall spiritually, we can come back. This was a complaint people had about, there's a certain genre of biographies of great rabbis. The biographies tend to follow a very similar line. You know, when they were 4 year old, they knew the whole Talmud. When they were 5 year old, you know, they knew later. And you know, there's like superhuman accomplishments that are very, very unbelievable. And you know, we can read them, we could be very, very impressed with them, but they don't necessarily carry a message to us, because they are madrigot that are beyond. But it was pointed out by a very, very great and astute observer that sometimes we have to know that when someone becomes like the Chafetz Chaim, someone, for example, who never spoke Lashon Hara, somebody who fell asleep if you begin gossiping, you know, he didn't become that way when he was 5 years old. You know, we know him when he was 70, when he was 80, when he was 90. But he too probably had to struggle. He too may have failed. We don't know exactly. We don't have records of those early struggles. But sometimes being aware of the struggles and even the failures of a great person and how they surmount those failures and go beyond them is more inspirational and more meaningful than a record of successes. So this idea that the Baal Tshuva can be saved from the arrogance of complacency is actually a reason why the Malchut went to David HaMelech instead of you. I'm sorry, do you want to say something?
This says basically, and then some of the essence of this discussion here, it's saying that the tzaddik cannot be a tzaddik, it has to go okay. I understand it should have a limit. Okay, but that says, hey, if you really want to be a good journalist, you have to find the tshuva once in a while. Baal tshuva, that means you own the answer.
Mm-hmm. Well, literally, yeah.
And to own the answer is commit a crime. Do something bad.
Well,
okay, like David. Yeah. And then you become famous and you take
well, yeah. Well, there is, you know, Jacob Frank, who is the infamous successor of Shabtai Tzvi. The Frankists were really one of the most despicable renegade breakaway groups in Jewish history. Jacob Frank actually did teach. He actually perverted it. Since the Baal Tshuva is more beloved than the Tzaddik, we should tell all of our people to sin as much as they can so they could do tshuva, because they never got to the tshuva part. They only did the first part. But that was Frank's teaching. Sin, achieve redemption through sin. Yeah, obviously we don't say that, but I think the short answer basically is that look at it in terms of nisayon. I mean, we're not saying that the tzaddik, it's impossible for a tzaddik not to have humility. We are saying it's a little harder. And indeed, it's something that one needs to work on a little bit more. We're not saying better to sin, but we're saying that if one has failed and one has grown from that failure, there's a certain strengthening that one has that one might not have. One never was exposed to that.
I view the tzaddik as basically people looking at another individual and say he's a tzaddik, but he, the individual himself internally, mm-hmm. knew himself that he really among the people in the group.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There is a big distinction. So we call somebody a tzaddik.
Right.
But he himself should be a tzaddik.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's very so. Yeah. I mean, obviously, and tshuva, you know, has so many levels. So even if somebody is perfectly righteous as far as we can see, the tzaddik's own self-perception, gives him infinite levels. There's really infinite levels. In fact, this, by the way, was another debate. I'm not sure if Rabbi Nadler brings this, but this was a famous debate between the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rav Shneur Zalman, and Mitnagdim, because in Hasidut it was taught that even the perfect tzaddik must always do tshuva. And one of the attacks against the Hasidic movement was, this was degrading the role of the tzaddik by implying the tzaddik did hidden averot. Why are you insulting the tzaddik? You're kind of, again, egalitarianism, making everybody the same. And Rav Shneur Zalman's famous response was that tshuva is not simply a matter you did something wrong and you correct it, but tshuva is drawing ever and ever closer to God by growing in your perception of godliness and spirituality, and therefore it's the opposite. One who is gifted with a closer connection to God must exploit that connection on a deeper and deeper and deeper level and not remain still. To be stagnant, again, to quote a parallel Vilna Gaon quotation, because you can always find a parallel, the Vilna Gaon says, there is no such thing as a Jew living on a plateau. Meaning, if one is not consciously involved in growing aliyah, there is yirida inevitably. You cannot stay in place. There has to be that. And that's indeed a very, that by the way is a very, very significant problem in Jewish life generally. Of course, going back to the prophets talk about this. It's very hard to segment ideas as belonging to a particular epoch. I mean, the prophets talk about mitzvat anashim alumada, doing commandments out of habit, doing them mechanically. How do you escape the ruts and the roads? Very difficult. And in a way, the longer one is observant of Jewish practices, the greater the nisayon is. Because the one who is doing something new, there's a certain excitement in it. After a while, that way, which by the way might be yet another reason why the Baal Tshuva might be in a higher level, because there's a greater passion and excitement than someone who's been habituated. Yeah.
I have trouble a little bit by the perception of what true humility is, that's being stated. We find that Moshe was chastised for who he was actually, according to many commentators, he was punished for not seizing the moment when God told him, you should be the chosen one. He kept saying that I'm not worthy.
Right.
He was punished for that. And
right.
King Shaul was also punished. He lost his malchus for not standing up to the people when he knew, when he had a position to do so.
Right.
And it seems that true humility is knowing exactly what you are, and yet that humility means that what you are indebts you to society that much more, but it means that you're not owed anything for it,
right.
But it puts you more in debt.
Yeah.
But it's not that you walk around saying that I am nothing,
right.
And therefore I don't owe anything to society.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, obviously, those two stories, which I gave, illustrate bad humility or false humility. No, you're 100% correct. Humility, let's take Moshe, right? The Torah says Moses is the most humble person who walked the earth. Now, that doesn't mean, you know, Moses thought, you know, he was dumb, he was stupid, gee, everybody there knows more than him. I mean, that would be delusional, that would be psychotic. God would not praise as a moral quality something which is not true. Rather, humility presupposes, as you say, an awareness of one's potential, an awareness of one's greatness, a great self-esteem in the sense of knowing that I am capable of accomplishing significant things on this earth, that God has given each of us a mission, and we must strive to fulfill that mission to the best of our abilities, and to identify our abilities, and use them to the utmost. A modesty which obscures or denies those abilities would be a betrayal of the gifts that God has given us. Rather, humility says, with a full awareness of what I am, I recognize that my talents, whatever they are, call forth responsibilities to God, and as compared to God, again, they come from God, therefore I don't take arrogance in them, I don't look down at others, I recognize other people's greatness and their potential. But it's not an upstream. This is where there's a great difficulty, where we sometimes equate humility with self-debasement or self-abuse, which is obviously not the case at all. And it's the other way. That type of false humility is actually a yetzer hara, which is designed to let me off the hook by giving me a sense I don't owe anything to the world because there's nothing I can contribute.
All those pieces to this issue, actually, and to some degree, at least, I don't know exactly, it might be looking at I'm looking at page 244, where he talks about part of the issue with Saul is that his misdeed is in relationship to his, as he puts it here, the kingly arch,
Yep.
So you can say it's in that area of being a king as mm-hmm. opposed to just his humanity. It's
right.
Actually smack the current political situation.
Yep. Yeah, but I've used this.
The same argument about
yeah.
2 years ago.
Yeah.
And then apparently he doesn't like this argument quite well enough, and so divides it up into exactly what the king of the art has
right.
proposed of.
Right.
I think that he's disturbed by the same thing that we've been disturbed at, is at what point is it humility, and at what point is it an understanding of what one's duties are.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be humble to say, humble in the good way, to say, well, I'm not going to be king anymore because I'm such a worthless person.
Mm-hmm.
You'd be humble to say, I want to do the best job I can do as a king, and if I don't, then I failed in doing that, but not because I took on the job, but because I did
right. Yeah, well, that's a very good point. And in fact, that's a classic. Saul is considered to be a classic instance of really misplaced humility, which resulted in an inability to fulfill the responsibilities of his office. And indeed, that's quoted many, many times, both in this Sefer and from other Sfarim, that Shaul's reticence, Shaul was indeed a very, very humble person, but it had an effect sometimes of paralyzing his ability to carry forth his job. And as we say, we have to reconcile it. Again, it goes back to, as was encapsulated in the Hasidic movement, that famous idea that you have to have two thoughts in each pocket. One is Anokhi Yafo V'Efer, I am dust and ashes, and the other is Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam, because of me the world was created. And the humility does not negate at all the sense of purpose and mission and significance that a human being has. And of course, you know, as parents, as teachers, this is something that we struggle with every day in terms of how we relate to our children. You know, it's interesting that in California, what was it? You know, the old self-esteem movement, which in education is around 20 years old now. So I think in California they discovered that they kind of they reduced the math and English things, and for 3 hours a week, kids have to get up and in front of the class and say why they're great. You know, so I'm great because, you know, I flat, whatever they say. And they noticed that it hasn't really resulted in an improvement of testing scores or anything else. And the truth is that self-esteem is wonderful, but it ultimately has to be grounded in letting people realize what their talents are, what they can contribute, to kind of yank it out of a context of significant life experience. It then just turns into an empty incantation because it's not rooted in anything. That's why some people prefer the term self-respect to self-esteem. Self-respect implies a certain amount of earning. But be it as it may, that really brings us now to the Sefer Ikarim. If you know that... Oh, yes, one final point about the Chavetz Chaim. Again, I just want to remind people of the beautiful thoughts that he expresses at the very end, in which he recognizes that sometimes tshuva appears to be impossible because we cannot undo the damage that we caused. But if we sincerely try to do what we can, God will create the circumstances. Even if we don't even know them, meaning if we hurt somebody and we don't know where that person is and we can't find them, God is going to kind of miraculously put into that person's heart a desire to forgive you. If we do what we can, even though we haven't done the whole thing. And therefore he says, we should not use our inability to complete the process as an excuse. And of course, again, going back to Pirkei Avot, which he does not quote, Lo alecha hamlacha ligmor, it is not upon you to finish the job. But Iyata ben Charin li bato menena, you are not free to stop doing it, and that applies to tshuva as well. And in English we have the saying that often the best is the enemy of the better, and that is, in our attempts to do the best, when that becomes unattainable, we do nothing. And that's an enemy, because real progress can be made, even if it's not going to be the best. Don't allow the best to be the enemy of the better. Okay, but this is the Chavetz HaLevavot, and again, stylistically, what's striking to me, at least, was that the Chavetz HaLevavot very, very rarely, and I made this point last week, relies directly on rabbinic texts. There are not any quotations from the Talmud or the Midrash, although much of his theology is, of course, based on that, but he tends to rely directly on the Bible, on the Tanakh, and on common sense arguments, and I think that largely because he is addressing an audience. Remember, this was written in Arabic, so it wasn't even a Hebrew audience necessarily, who were not necessarily so committed to traditional sources, but he's trying to give them an ethical framework. Now, this is greatly contrasted with the other passage that we're going to talk about today from the Sefer Ikarim. For example, if you are a yeshiva trained person who is used to Talmud and Midrash and the like, you probably find the Sefer Ikarim an easier type of book to deal with because it deals with the familiar materials of rabbinic discourse, passages in Talmud, passages in Midrash, etc. It's kind of a more natural way. The book was written in Hebrew, so he was dealing with an audience that was somewhat conversant with rabbinic literature. One thing you will notice is that the Sefer HaKarim is verbose, meaning to say he is ma'arich. He is very, very lengthy in his expositions, and that mirrors the style of the Abarbanel as well. In fact, even the translator, this by the way is a very, very good translation compared to the Hebrew, Professor Husek, who wrote a treatise on history of medieval Jewish philosophy, the standard work. Even Isaac Husek, who is the translator, you'd figure he'd have some affection for the Sefer Ikarim, expresses his irritation in the introduction that this book is just too long. This was his own position. But a little history about what the Sefer Ikarim is about, and then you'll understand where these chapters come from. The Sefer Ikarim, which was written in the 15th century, in the 1400s, mid-1400s, by Yosef Alba, who lived in Italy, was essentially a rejoinder or a criticism of Maimonides. Maimonides articulates, as we know, what are called 13 principles of faith. There are 13 principles of faith which define the Jewish creed. And actually, we have not actually covered them specifically. I'm sure many of you are familiar with them. We will probably look at it in our next class. But Maimonides took the position that if a Jew does not believe these 13 principles, they are defined as a heretic and they forfeit their membership, as it were, in the Jewish people. Of course, we'll have to explain what that means as well, because there is a concept of a Jew by birth. But we'll see how Maimonides deals with that. Rav Albo argued that Maimonides fails to distinguish between what is called an ikar. Ikar means a root, a fundamental principle, and what is called an anaf, which is a branch. He says, some of Maimonides' principles are ikarim, and some of them are anafim. And if one believes, that's why it's called Sefer HaIkarim, the book of the fundamental roots, and consequently, if one denies an ikar, one might be a heretic, but if one denies an anaf, one might be mistaken. Again, he is not denying the truth of anything Maimonides said. I'll give you an example of this. But he is saying that some of those truths are secondary truths and not primary truths. And therefore, you can be a mistaken Jew, but you're not yet a heretical Jew. And specifically, let me give you the examples. Albo argued there are only three principles which are ikarim, and everything else is anafim. And the three principles are mitziyut Hashem, the existence of an almighty God who created the world. That is principle number one. Now, within that principle, we have various anafim. God doesn't have a body, etc. But he says like this, if a person believed, I mean, this is obviously an inconsistent Jewish belief, if a person believed God had a physical form of some way, that would be a mistaken belief, but that would not go to the ikar, as long as you believe that God is there's the supreme creator. Principle number two is sechar va'onesh, reward for virtue, onesh, punishment for evil. That doesn't mean in this world, of course, but in some ultimate way, God holds us accountable for the goodness and evil that we do in the world. Now, based on that, Rav Albo says, things like Maimonides writes about resurrection of the dead and Mashiach, Rav Albo says, those are not ikarim. Those are just the ways that God eventually gives reward and punishment. Now, again, people often mistake this. People often say, like, I'll give you an example of how there's a certain subtlety here. People often say, oh, so Rav Albo says a Jew doesn't have to believe in Mashiach. So that's not true. Rav Albo agrees with Maimonides in terms of the truth of Judaism 100%. Of course there's Mashiach. Of course there's Tchiyat HaMetim. All he's saying is, as a matter of classification, it is not an ikar, it is an anak. So if a Jew, for example, only believed in the world of the soul and did not believe in physical resurrection, Maimonides would call that person a heretic. Rav Alba would call that person a mistaken Jew, who is not yet a heretic. It is only a shoresh and not an ikar. Olam haba. In other words, these are just the ways God gives you reward. But the principle is reward and punishment. Principle number three that Rav Alba says is an ikar is Torah min hashamayim, that the Torah, God's will, was expressed to the Jewish people by a process of divine revelation. It was not made up, and that includes all the things Maimonides writes about Moses, prophecy, and everything else. Now, if you think about this, in a general sense, these three principles represent God as creator, number one, and reward and punishment is God as intervener in human history, that God cares about how human beings behave. And principle number three is God has communicated good and evil. In other words, Schar V'Onesh is accountability for good and evil. But that doesn't yet tell you what is good and evil. Good and evil might be left to an instinct. So Torah Min HaShemayim says the definition of good and evil is in fact based on revelation, and it's not based on subjective ethics. Right? So Yosef Alba's argument is, if you have those three Ikarim, you are a believing Jew, even if you're mistaken in various details. So the Sefer HaIkarim is divided into four parts. Part number one is simply his argument against Maimonides regarding Ikar and not Ikar. And then each other part is devoted to
to go against the philosophical ways of thinking of those days, and it is more to incorporate what the Ikar is. I mean, it seems it's more of like a treatise of outrage against what was going on in those days than it is just transformation.
Well, you know, obviously there is a polemical aspect too, and in fact, the Sefer HaIkarim was written in the aftermath of a very, very famous public disputation with the Catholic Church that Rav Alba was involved in. So in fact, there's no doubt that there was some influence in that. But in terms of the Ikarim, once again, he considers, for example, that the Shurashit, that the Anathim are Nichlal in these different Ikarim.
I'm also having trouble understanding, from my mind's perspective, if a person doesn't believe in Tchiyat HaMetzim, then he's really ruining one of the first premises of the perfection of God.
Mm-hmm. What, that the body...
Well, you're saying that there's a flaw in God's creation. If eventually will not achieve a perfection, then you're saying it was flawed from the start. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you're saying there's a flaw in God's design, then you're saying there's a flaw in God.
Well, I mean, you could make that same argument about animals. You know, animals are not physically resurrected, and yet when their bodies disintegrate, they don't come back. So obviously, through various processes of removal, God makes things that are subject to decay, which do not reflect on the essence of God. In other words, if you're telling me that since God is perfect, whatever God makes must somehow have some perfection and enduring, that could apply to every single thing that decays.
And man specifically, because God designed man to accomplish something for the world.
Okay, but then once again, the aspect of man that is godly is the neshama. The neshama, even if you deny physical resurrection, the neshama, which comes from God, does endure forever. But I'll come back to that. I don't want to talk about that right now. But I just want to say, by the way, that resurrection of the dead, Maimonides himself was accused of denying physical resurrection as one of the Ikrei Emunah, because in the Mishnah Torah he doesn't mention it. He talks about only Olam Haba, the life of the soul. And Maimonides had to write a very lengthy letter called Igeret Tchiyat HaMetim, in which he says that he does believe in it, and he mentioned it as one of the 13 principles of faith, and then gave kind of a reason why he didn't mention in the Mishnah Torah. So Maimonides himself, it's not entirely, I mean, obviously he believed in it and said it was Nikar Emunah, but he certainly de-emphasized it in many of his writings. Now,
this is happening in the context of the public dissertation. Yeah. So is it possible either have been somewhat swayed by the arguments of the Christians, or who might be, not to throw too many people in the pool of heretics, but rather say not everybody. It seems almost like a Kira's attack.
Well, yes, and in fact he does have some very startling remarks, such as, he could believe that various Mashiachs came and gone, to be a reference, and that would not undermine his attachment to the Jewish people. But again, what's very important in reading the Sefer Ikarim, not so much in the chapters we have here, is you have to differentiate between the author's own beliefs and his tolerance of the mistaken beliefs of others. So when Rav Albo says, for example, a Jew could be a faithful Jew even if he doesn't believe in Mashiach, he is not making a statement that he doesn't believe in Mashiach. He is making a statement that Mashiach is an anaf and not an ikar, and consequently, not believing in Mashiach is an erroneous belief that does not condemn one as a heretic. Now this was a point, by the way, that was consistently misunderstood by countless generations who read the Sefer Ikarim, because Rav Albo was often criticized as having heretical tendencies himself in not believing in Mashiach and not believing in resurrection, because he'll go pages and pages to show you why you don't have to believe in Mashiach. But you have to, and again, and since he writes in a very lengthy way, you could be reading it for 25 pages and think this is what he's saying, but you have to remember that's not what he's saying. What he's saying is, he's explaining why something is not an ikar, and therefore it's only an anaf, right? So that's why it's kind of a strange book in some ways, because he is justifying ideas that he himself would certainly reject, but he's simply saying that this could still be within the realm of a faithful Jew. And that way you could, if you want to use a modern label on it, there's kind of a pluralistic approach to Jewish theology that is implicit in the Sefer HaYikarim's formulation. By the way, some commentators have pointed out that the Sefer HaYikarim's trilogy might be a mirror that explains the structure of the Rosh Hashanah Amidah, again, which of course is more than 1,000 years earlier than this book. And that is, if you look at the Musaf of the Rosh Hashanah Amidah, you'll notice there are three intermediate blessings, all of which have a similar, and we blow the shofar after each of those blessings. There is what is called Malchuyot. Malchuyot are the recitation of Psukim, 10 verses, three from the Torah, three from the writings, three from the prophets, and then one from the Torah. 10 verses altogether, which proclaim God's sovereignty, God's Malchut. And then we have Zichronot, which are verses that talk about God remembering the good deeds of our patriarchs and matriarchs, Zichronot. And the third group of psukim are shofrot, verses dealing with the blowing of the shofar. Remember, in the repetition of the Shemon Esrei, as each of those sections are finished, we blow the shofar, which is a form of inarticulate prayer, by the way. The shofar is the cry of the soul, which is not articulated into words. In fact, it's very interesting. The shofar is performing a prayer function at that moment. We are crying out to God. Now, the thing is this. The Maharsha, who lived in Poland in the 16th century, so around 100 years after the Ikarim, actually says that perhaps this is the structure. Because Malchuyot, that talks about God's kingship derives from his status as creator. And therefore, that is the proclamation of God as creator of the world and supreme king. Zichronot, which talks about God remembering goodness, is the notion of accountability, reward and punishment. God remembers, so what we do counts, whether it's good or bad. That's schar v'onesh. Shofrot, now this is a little less clear, but if you look at the specific verses that are quoted from Shofrot, you will find that the Torah verses all concern the shofar of Matan Torah. And therefore, that reminds us of Torah min HaShamayim. So the Marsha actually reads back into the structure of the Rosh Hashanah Amidah, the three Ikarim of Rav Yosef Albo. Now, the Sefer Ikarim was an enormously popular work. It's a little less so today because the translation is over 50 years old and you can't get it, it's totally out of print, but it was a very, very popular work. It's a much easier read then Maimonides, etc. It was popular in rabbinic audiences because he draws a lot on the Talmud and the Midrash. It was popular among non-rabbinic audiences because, number one, it gave a certain tolerance and eclecticism to what was acceptable Jewish theology. It was even popular among Christians. It was translated into Latin and was read by Christian theologians as a definitive statement of Jewish belief. So it was a very, very popular work. In terms of the underlying ideas, again, he was a disciple of Chasdei Kreskes, who wrote his own philosophical work, Or Hashem, which is a much more complicated work, which has never been translated, and Rav Albo, in terms of originality, largely adapted and popularized the teachings of his teacher. But once again, in terms of the bestseller, the Sefer HaKarim was a much bigger bestseller than was the Or Hashem.
How do you spell his name?
Which one? Albo? A-L-B-O, Aleph Lamed Bet Vav, Yosef Albo. So, now one of the interesting things that Rav Albo liked, Rav Albo was also a preacher. That was his parnassah. And one gets a sense of this from the book itself, because Rav Albo might state a philosophical idea, like Chovet HaLevavot will state a philosophical idea and just state the idea. Rav Albo will then take you through all the biblical verses, verse by verse by verse, to show you how his idea fits this phrase and this phrase and this phrase and this phrase. So the truth of the matter is that even when he put on the hat of the philosopher, he was still very much the preacher and the biblical interpreter. So what I want to look at today is some very interesting things. He has some very interesting biblical interpretations of some famous passages in the Torah, which are, again, I don't know if they were original with him or they were also taken, but again, they do not appear in other famous commentaries.
original with him, or they were also taken, but again, they do not appear in other famous commentaries as we know them. So we have an excerpt here. Chapter 21 and 22. This, by the way, is from part 4. Part 4 deals with reward and punishment. And in the section dealing with reward and punishment, he has a long discussion about the book of Job, which we'll look at a little later on, but he discusses tshuva and the like. And this is that ikar of reward and punishment. Yeah.
Did you say in part 3 when God reveals, that's part 3.
Yes, part 3. He reverses it. Part 1 is his general introduction. Yeah, there are 4 parts. Yeah, yeah. And this is from the 4th part. Now, chapter 21 deals with the efficacy of prayer. By the way, and again, some of this is taken out of context. We'll have a discussion of prayer later. But the Sefer HaKarim, not in the chapter that's here, but it'll be in the book. The Sefer HaKarim this is perhaps the most famous position that he takes. He discusses, why does prayer ever help? You know, God does what he wants. So God either gives you what he wants to give you, or he doesn't give you what he wants to give you. How is God influenced by your begging him? Does God respond, as it were, to people begging? And Rivaldo's famous position is that the reason tefillah helps is not because it changes God's mind, but the tefillah effects a self-transformation within me. That by my encounter with God, I become a different person. And because I am now different, God relates to me on a different level. Not because God changes. God is constant. But obviously what God does is a function of who I am. And tefillah is a medium of self-transformation. It should be pointed out that this is actually very, very consistent with the very grammatical term of tefillah. Because let's take the word lehitz palel. Lehitz palel. Now, the shoresh is pei lamed lamed, the root, palel. Now, palel is a root that refers to judge someone, judgment or evaluation. We find, for example, in the Chumash that a judge, if a woman gets hurt and she takes her, the people who hit her to court, the Nasan Baplilim, the judges shall assess the fine. Now, so Palel means to judge. Now, Lehit Palel is the Hit Palel Binyan, which is a reflexive. So very literally, Lehit Palel means to engage in a process of self-introspection and evaluation. Just like Lehit Rachetz is to wash yourself, Lehit Palel is to engage in a self-judgment. I mean, the word is kemat beferish, it's kemat explicit, that the efficacy of prayer is because of the transformative effects that it has on the individual who stands before God. So that's actually a famous, very, very famous idea that Rivaldo develops. Yeah.
Therefore,
he
gets closer to God. Is it that, or is it
a
person who changes himself, therefore
he
deserves a new
din, or is given one, a new judge? Yeah, both are true. The point is, as the person changes, he's closer to God. As the person changes, God has to evaluate him differently, because God gives us based on a din that we have, and our din changes. Yeah.
Maybe you can go along with the anomalous thing. When you do Shabbat,
that's correct. That's right. Yeah. 100% correct. As you note, Maimonides even mentions this idea in terms of superficial things. You know, we change a person's name. I'm sure you're familiar with this custom. If someone is very, very ill, there's a procedure for changing a name or adding a name, and the Rambam says, because he's different, if God decreed that Reuven, God forbid, die, and now he's Raphael Reuven, different person. Well, if that's true for those types of changes, certainly when a person changes by tshuva, they deserve a different din. But Rav Albo's point is, this change is not only affected by tshuva, but it's affected by tefillah. That prayer has to be a transformative encounter. Again, our prayer, well, I shouldn't speak for our, I'll speak for myself, but it's so unfortunate that our prayer is often so impoverished. How often do we walk away from prayer feeling as if we have been transformed? You know, it becomes a burden sometimes, we do it, or on a good week we may enjoy it, good day, but the idea of transformation, that's a very, very difficult thing. Although there is a statement that is said from that if a person prays and does not have a sense they are standing in the presence of God, their prayer, they haven't done anything at all. No, it's not even an act of prayer. It's not like, you know, if you eat matzah on Passover and you weren't thinking about it, you've still eaten matzah. You've done a mitzvah. But prayer without awareness that one is standing before God is said to be not prayer at all. And here is the little problem I have just educationally. You know, when we teach children how to read Hebrew, so we often use the Siddur as a first text, quite properly so. And part of how we determine their skill level is how fast they can go through the words. So it's a point of pride to be able to say a page of davening, of prayer, as quickly as possible. Well, maybe that's a reasonable talent when one is five or one is six or seven, learning how to read. But unfortunately, it continues to be a point of pride as people get older, when in fact it ought to be the opposite, that there ought to be the notion of taking one's time to think about the words that one is saying, that the tefillah should be a transformative effect on a person. Because Rav Albo says that's the only way prayer works. Prayer works because we're changed, not because God changes. Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
No, well, of course that's true, and that goes back to the notion of, once again, the fact that I can't do it the way it should be done doesn't mean I don't do it. I do what I can, and once again, you can actually pray to God to give you the ability to pray to God. You can pray to be able to pray, and that's also a prayer that God answers. What do they say? That a person can pray, a person should want to do the mitzvot. Let's say a person doesn't want to do the mitzvot. So you can pray that you want to want. No. And I think the Ari writes there are 13 levels of that. You can pray to want, to want, to want, to want, to want, to want, to want. He says, and that's still going to be effective. Wanting to want is also a certain type of level. But
There is something about the fact that if you say the words quickly enough, you can maintain your concentration on it.
Oh yeah.
And the mind works much more quickly than we can read or speak, and so there has to be a certain cadence.
No, you're right. But that's already a tactical question. I mean, and you are
right.
Correct. There are two schools of thought, and the answer is it depends on the individual. There are two schools of thought. What is the optimal pace at which one should pray with intention and devotion? There are those that say the concept is say the words very, very slowly. But there are others that say, no, when you say things too slowly, your mind wanders and your concentration falters, and therefore it's better to do it like in phrases. Yeah, so that's very, very legitimate. In fact, even among great Hasidic rebbes, you will find two different styles of davening. There's the people that may take an hour for Shemona Esrei, and there are those that will do it in 2 minutes. And, you know, that depends on the person. I'm not advocating that, you have to pray slowly. I'm just advocating that we should pray with thinking about what we're saying. And that may involve fast or may involve slow. That depends on the pace. However, I would say this, that at a minimum, since prayer is called conversation to God, it should be at the pace at which you would converse. Even if you talk fast. And it's very, very clear that the standard pace in a synagogue is faster than one would converse. You know, so there's a little bit of problem. You can't say the words that fast, yeah.
Well, if the Shliach Tzibur in the synagogue were to daven very slowly because he was going through some transformation, yeah, he would be prodded by the shul, and he might not have his position, he might not have his parnasa.
Well, that's a consideration. I guess that'll give him more kavana to pray for his parnasa. there is a concept. No, and again, and there are countervailing ideas here. When you're a Shliach Tzibur in particular, you know, you don't cause inconvenience to the congregation. That is a concept as well. And I would say Shliach Tzibur has it a little better, because the Shliach Tzibur has two chances, because he repeats the Amidah. So consequently, he can get it right in the second one. But when you only have one chance, you want to be careful. Yeah.
But speaking of the Amidah, there's almost like a flaw in the service itself, because everybody said the Amidah is a very crucial part of the service, and yet people go at a different pace. And one of the problems with the Amidah is how different people finish at a different time. You're still standing, and they're already on their own, and your palace and all those other things. I see this all the time.
It does happen.
And only sometimes does a rabbi, for instance, say that if you finish the Amidah before everybody else, just sit down quietly, you know, and reflect, and let's give everybody else a chance to finish. But it's rare that everybody really has a chance to finish.
Well, you're raising two separate problems. One is the issue of I'm still praying when they're going on with the service. And the other is the fact that people might be talking or walking around or doing things. And, you know, the second thing is wrong halakhically. There are many, many strict halakhot about not conversing, not having conversations in synagogues, not disturbing the prayers of other people. These are widely ignored halakhot, ranging in every synagogue, from the most orthodox to the least affiliated. But nevertheless, these are wrong, and it's totally improper. Yeah. Yep, that's very good, yeah.
Maybe the most important reason for the need to develop as an art, as opposed to just
I think that is a very good point, and you know, many people are profoundly moved by the particular nigunim of the Yamim Noraim in particular, and that's a very important function of the Chazan, to inspire people in that way. However, the truth of the matter is, too, though, that people do need a certain amount of advanced preparation, meaning when you're dealing with a complicated service that only comes once or twice a year, people need to sit down with a machzor ahead of time and look at the prayers, understand their structure, and then they can approach it in a much more meaningful way. Okay, now that is really before we reach chapter 21. That is the famous thought of the Sefer Yikarim, which, by the way, was picked up by later people like Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch in the 19th century, but this has now become a commonly accepted understanding, one of the understandings at least, of the Koach of Tefillah, is the transformation that it has on the individual, making him a different receptacle for the beneficence of God's grace.
Do you mean Alva was the person who first said that?
I can't say he's the first one that said it, but he's the first one that widely popularized that concept. This is one of probably the most famous idea of the Sefer Yikarim that has gotten wide currency. Now, if you then look at chapter 21, and we can't cover it page by page, he does raise the question about Moses, right? Moses, God decrees that Moshe, will not be able to enter the land of Israel. And Moshe says, I pray to God over and over again to be able to enter the land of Israel. And God's answer to me was, no, I cannot enter the land of Israel. And Rav Albo says, why wasn't Moshe's prayer answered? The answer he gives, he does not give a philosophical answer per se in chapter 21. He gives what we will call a technical answer. And that is, he differentiates, and again, this is actually rooted in the Talmud, in a passage in the Talmud, in Tractate Rosh Hashanah. He differentiates between prayer before God has made a decree, which is called Kodem Gezar Din, and prayer after God has made a decree, which is called Achar Gezar Din. And then he makes a further distinction, which again is based on the Gemara, he did not invent this, between a Gezar Din Sheyesh Imo Shavua, a Gezar Din that is accompanied by a divine oath, and a gezar din she'ein imo shavua, and a decree that is not accompanied by a divine oath. And he suggests that the efficacy of tefillah and shuvah, for that matter, is not only before gezar din, but even after gezar din. But it terminates, he says, once it is a gezar din she'yesh imo shavua, vis-a-vis an individual. We'll come to a community in a second. Now, this is a very, very technical answer, and the reason why it doesn't really help us a lot in our daily avodat Hashem is because we never know. We never know where we are. In other words, vis-a-vis what God has in store for us. Has there already been a gezar din? Has there not been a gezar din? Has God coupled it with a shavuah? Now, the two instances of shavuah that he enunciates are that when God decreed that Moshe would not enter the land of Israel, God used a word lochein, therefore, which is interpreted as an emphatic terminology of shavuah. And the other instance he adduces is in the beginning of the book of Samuel, when God decreed that the house of Eli would be wiped out and all of his children would die young, and that of course happened. It also used a lochem, a lashon of shavuah, but of course that was a communicated. God communicated that to a prophet. We're not really clear how that works otherwise, but basically he does say until... So let me give you an example of how this might work. We say, for example, on Rosh Hashanah, God writes down what's going to happen to us the coming year. This is really how we would explain it. On Yom Kippur, it is already sealed. Now, here's the question. If by Yom Kippur, 2 days ago, God made a final decision, who will live, who will die, who will be well, who will be ill, who will be rich, who will be poor, then what is the purpose of my praying today to heal the ill? God decreed that. So Rav Albo's answer, which I think is really a Talmudic answer, is yes, by the time Yom Kippur has passed, there is a gezar din. God has issued a decree. But tefillah can help even when there is a gezar din, unless it is called a gezar din sheyesh lo shavuah, and since none of us knows in particular whether there's a shavuah or not, we have to live our lives on the assumption that tefillah has a potential efficacy even after Yom Kippur. So this idea that tefillah helps even after gezar din is really implicit in the notion that we continue to pray every single day, even though the Yom Kippur was already the decision for the year. Because if God forbid it was a negative decision, tefillah could still help. Yeah.
Then how does the Shana
run? Okay, so that's a little different. That's already in the Zohar. That's not in the Talmud. The Zohar indicates that until Hashanah Rabbah, we're still in a transitional period. Rosh Hashanah is Ketiva, the writing. Yom Kippur is Chatima, the signing, the sealing. And then Hoshana Rabbah, Hashem delivers the judgments to the various angels to carry them out. So right now, it's as if there is a sealed judgment in the judge's office. But even Hoshana Rabbah is not a Shavuah yet. Because remember, we daven after Hoshana Rabbah too. I mean, the point basically is, unless you have a Shavuah, and we never know that situation, one should never lose hope. Even after Gezar Din, there is always hope for Tefillah.
Nevertheless, tefillah people were able to overcome it. For example, the Medrash says that David HaMelech was supposed to be born stillborn.
Mm-hmm.
Adam Rishon was misspelled very much to be 7 years of his life for David to be born,
mm-hmm,
in order to be tikkun,
right,
the Mashiach should be misakin,
right,
the Avera, the original faith.
Mm-hmm.
We also find that Avraham Avinu was not supposed to have any children, and Hashem had to change his name in order to allow him,
mm-hmm,
to have children, and
right,
change Sarah's name, where there was ordained, you know, sure by God that
I cannot, but
if I change your name, then I can't.
Yeah, well, we don't know exactly the concept of God's Shavuah. We don't know what God's oath is exactly.
And he does say to Abraham with the stars.
Right, but that's not necessarily the same as an oath. In other words, we have to differentiate, until we have a clear understanding, which I don't have, of the difference between Gezar Din, a divine decree, and a divine decree that is solidified with an oath. It would be hard for me. I couldn't tell you if that falls under Gezar Din or under Gezar Din Sheish Shavuah. But be it as it may, he then makes a second point. Of course, the second one may answer your question as well. And that he says that all of these restrictions only apply for the prayer of the individual. But when it comes to a community, and this is divided into two ways, either an individual who prays for a community or a community who prays, God is accessible and amenable to that prayer at all times. And this is a very, very fundamental teaching of Judaism. This is why it is preferable to pray with a minyan, which is a microcosm of a community, because God relates to the community of Israel in a more favorable and openly loving way than God might relate to particular individuals. So when I stand before God as an individual, perhaps I am not worthy of divine mercy. When I stand before God as part of a community, the prayer of the community God listens to, even if it's a Gezar Din, Sheyesh Imo Shavuah. In other words, no matter how far it's gone, there's a certain idea that God listens to the prayer of the Tzibur. In fact, this is reflected in the halakha in very interesting ways. Let's assume a person cannot come to shul. And I have to pray at home, because I can't come to shul. I should still try to pray at the time the congregation is praying. That if they're praying at 10 o'clock, I ought to pray at 10 o'clock, because that is the way I connect myself to that congregation. Not only that, but let's say the other way. Let's say I can't show up for services, but I should still try to pray in the synagogue building, assuming you can get a key or whatever it is. Meaning, there's a concept that in the place of the congregation, even if the congregation isn't there, or with the congregation at the same time, even though you're not with them, it's a linkage to the community. And that's extremely important. In fact, the Ari writes that before, much later, before a person prays the Amidah, he or she should think to themselves that they accept upon themselves the commandments, v'ahavtel reyecha kamocha, of loving your fellow Jew as you love yourself, because by linking yourself to others, you merit a certain divine mercy that you would not have standing as an individual. What is the story they tell? I'm not sure if I told you the story, but the notion of interdependence can give us many, many merits that we lack when we stand before God alone. Did I tell you a story about the life insurance? I don't want to repeat my story. I'll tell you the story very quickly. There was a great tzaddik in Yerushalayim, Levi Levin, who just died maybe 30 years ago. Very, very wonderful, wonderful, great person. And I guess even he was sometimes besought by salesmen who tried to pressure him to something. So he had a salesman that was trying to pressure him to get life insurance. So he couldn't afford it, he didn't want to get it. And the person said, well, you know, this gives you protection, or gives your family protection in the event you die. So he said, no, it's exactly the opposite. What was the story? His story was, every year on Rosh Hashanah, God decides whether I'm supposed to live or I'm supposed to die. And Ravadi was very humble. So he said, I know that I myself don't have merits to live. And every time the angels probably say, this man ought to die. But another angel pops up and says, he can't die because Rebetzin Chana, his wife, needs him. And she's such a righteous woman. So every year I get saved because I'm needed. What's going to happen the first year I buy life insurance? And the angel is going to say, he deserves to die. And the other angel will say, no, his wife needs him. The third angel will say, he doesn't need him, he has life insurance. So he says he's much better off without it. But you know, there is that concept of making yourself someone that someone else needs. And certainly when you're mechaber yourself, you connect yourself to the tzibur, there's a special koach. And in fact, Rav Alba makes it clear, by the way, that this cuts two ways. A prayer for a congregation will elicit God's mercy. But then there's another thing. A prayer for myself with a congregation. Now, there are two different things. I pray for my personal needs with the congregation, or I pray for the congregation. Either one of those things elicits Hashem's mercy. So that was really his technical answer. And he actually reads that into Moshe Rabbeinu's speech, where Moshe is telling the Jewish people, I prayed for God for myself, and God said no. But whenever you pray for God, for the Jewish people, God is going to answer your prayers.
It says at the end of the part of the reason why Hashem made Moshe brought the Etzim Hayom, because the Jewish people were trying to prevent Moshe from dying because of all the good that was done to him.
Right.
And we're going to try to prevent him and say, no, he won't die, we're not going to let it happen. And Hashem will say, no, I have prepared him to hold on, and that's the end of it. So if that being the case, why couldn't all the Jews make public prayer for Moshe to live?
Listen, in other words, obviously, again, we don't know all the mechanics of divine justice here. Obviously, it couldn't be the case that every time a congregation prays, they will always get what it is that they want for. I mean, we had prayer gatherings during the Holocaust, etc. You know, it doesn't always happen. All he's saying is, however, that there is no absolute preclusion, meaning it has a certain koach that a prayer of a yachid wouldn't have, but obviously we're not dealing with 100%. I mean, that couldn't be the case. We know that that's not always the case.
We know whether Abba had a Kabbalistic background.
It doesn't seem likely, but I couldn't speak to it. It seems not. Yeah. Now, here's the thing. I just want to share with you a little, in other words, so he really relies upon this from his interpretation of the Etchanan. Etchanan means, I pleaded to God, and God said no to me because God had sworn, but God will always be receptive to your prayers for the Jewish people, because that is the tefillah of a tzibur, as opposed to the tefillah of a yachid. Right? So that's a very, very important idea. Now, if I could digress for a second, I just want to share with you a thought on this. If you remember the context in which Moshe is addressing the Jewish people, and he's not praying now, he's addressing them before his death, and he's recounting that when God said he couldn't go in, he had prayed many, many times, and God said no. In fact, that's a tragic poignancy, that of all the people who would not enter the land of Israel, it would be Moshe. I mean, I think it's a meditation that we should have, as if you merit to fly to Eretz Israel, and as you go down and you see the green, the Tel Aviv, the coastline, and the buildings, think about the fact that we have the privilege to be able to come to a place that the greatest of all the Jews did not merit to come. Moshe died right beforehand. He was given the view of it, but he could not step in. So it's interesting that there's a verse there. If you go on in the verse, which he doesn't quote, Rav Avraham doesn't quote, it says, God was angry at me. Now, I prayed to God to be able to enter the land, but God was angry at me because of you. And God said, no. Now, when you read because of you, there's a certain jarring note there, because it's as if he's saying, you guys made me mess up with your impatience and your complaints, and God told me I can't go in. One would not expect a righteous leader to blame others. In fact, we see Rav Albo talks about that at great length, that one of the primary reasons that prevents us from doing tshuva is when we seek to put the blame on other people instead of assuming responsibility. Right? So how could Moshe say, God was angry at me because of you? So there's an interesting interpretation by Rabbeinu Nissim. Actually, it's very interesting, because Rabbeinu Nissim was a contemporary of Rav Albo. And in fact, Rabbeinu Nissim, a little earlier, he was in Spain, he was the teacher of Chasdai Kreskes, who was Albo's teacher. So it's interesting that Rabbeinu says an idea that is somewhat parallel to what the Sefer Yikarim says, but not exactly. And he says the following. The actual words are, God was angry at me for your sake, lemanchem. For your sake, God was angry. Not, in other words, he's not blaming them, but he's saying it was for your sake. What does that mean? He says that the book of Deuteronomy generally, the book of Devarim generally, is a book of tochacha, a book of rebuke, a book of musar. Right? Moshe is 1 month before his death. He's giving people final guidance and criticism. But the Ran is Rabbeinu Nissim, we often call him the Ran. Ran says that there are two aspects of giving musar, and this goes back to our discussion of humility. There is the pointing out of the flaws, pointing out the failures, pointing out the mistakes, pointing out all the ways you need to improve your ways. But there's a second aspect of Musar, which is to remind people of their potential for goodness, remind them of their greatness, remind them of what they could become, and remind them that they are beloved children of God. The Ram says, most of the book of Devarim, Moshe kind of gives them the tough line. You know, you've done this wrong, you've done this wrong, you've done this wrong, you sinned with the golden calf, you sinned with the spies, your forefathers, because they all died out, and you know, you're going to sin also, be careful, you know, you're prone to all sorts of things. But at this point, Moshe wants to reassure them of how beloved and special they are in God's eyes. And this is his point. His point is that all the sins that you committed, God has forgiven and lets you enter the land of Israel. But when I sin against you, and the Ram is assuming that the sin, we'll discuss this, the sin was the disrespect by which he referred to the Jewish people when he hit the rock. My sin against you is an unforgivable sin, because that is how beloved and treasured you are in the eyes of God. Because you have to keep in mind, if you keep in mind the mental picture here, you have to understand what a state of panic the Jewish people would be in when they hear that Moshe is going to die. Because, I mean, look at this. These were people who were either born in the desert or they were very young when they left Egypt. They had never known any other leader. What is life like in the desert anyway? You know, you got the man coming from heaven. You got the traveling water. You got the clouds of glory. They're in a spiritual cocoon, although they complained plenty, but nevertheless. Now they're going to a land of Israel in which, you know, there's not going to be the man from heaven. You're going to have to plant and plow. You're going to have to build cities and dig ditches and maintain armies and suffer casualties. And you're not going to have Moshe Rabbeinu, that very, very special leader. One could imagine there's a tremendous amount of fear and trepidation in their hearts. Are we going to be able to survive this intact, physically and spiritually in particular? So Moshe's job here is not only to criticize. Moshe's job is to reassure and to comfort. Therefore, the Ram stands it upside down. When Moshe says, God was angry at me because of you, the intention of his remark is not to say, you guys made me sin and it's your fault. It's the opposite. Because of your honor and your dignity and your respect, God did not forgive me. See how beloved you must be in God's eyes. See how much he cares about you. And therefore, have the confidence and the strength to be able to confront this new challenge, even without Moshe Rabbeinu. Because to some degree, the greatness of Moshe depends on the Jewish people, even more than vice versa. We find a similar idea with Eliyahu HaNavi. If you remember, Eliyahu HaNavi, the famous Eliyahu HaNavi, had a death sentence on his head. King Achav, Eliyahu HaNavi declared a famine for 3 years, a drought. And Achav was very angry about that, so Achav told Eliyahu HaNavi, if I ever find you, I'm going to kill you. And Eliyahu HaNavi was in hiding, was a fugitive for a number of years. And finally, when he comes out in the open, he has that great mass miracle on Mount Carmel. If you remember Mount Carmel, the prophets of the Baal erect an altar, and Eliyahu HaNavi erects an altar, and he calls upon, they call upon their God to ignite the Korban, and their God does not answer, and Eliyahu HaNavi says, well, maybe your God is taking a nap, shout a little louder, maybe Eliyahu mocks them, and Eliyahu HaNavi calls down from God, and a fire comes from heaven, and it consumes the offering. And everybody shouts out the same words by which we end the Yom Kippur service, Hashem Hu Elokim. God is the God. We say that 7 times. They shouted Hashem Hu Elokim. So you figured everybody did tshuva. And yet, what happens? Like our Yom Kippur sometimes, it lasted for 1 day. The next morning, Achav tells Eliyahu, Eliyahu, I'm still going to kill you. Don't think anything changed. At that point, Eliyahu HaNavi gets very disillusioned. At that point, he figured, I did my best stuff. Everything's the same. And he goes to God and he says, you know, these people nullified your covenant and they broke your covenant and they're unfaithful. And there's a very famous scene in which there's an earthquake and there's a storm, and God is not in the earthquake, God is not in the storm, God is not in the fire. and there's a small, quiet voice. And if you look at what's going on there, you essentially see what God does in a very polite way is he fires Eliyahu. He tells Eliyahu, go and anoint your successor, Elisha. And the message there is that when the shepherd loses faith in the goodness of his flock, he leaves. There is no second chance. When Moshe momentarily felt that the Jewish people were not deserving, this is what the Ran says, that's it. When Eliyahu feels the Jewish people are not deserving, that's it. Hashem will not forgive a leader losing faith in the goodness of his people. And that's what Moshe said. See how beloved you are. And of course, by the way, the Medrash tells us that because Eliyahu Hanavi declared to God, Es britcha heferu, they annul your brit, meaning they don't keep your covenant, it was decreed that Eliyahu Hanavi must show up at every brit, trying to see that the Jewish people, that we have a chair for Elijah the prophet, as if to say, you see, they do keep your brit, they're not so bad. You know, so be it as it may, this is what the Ran says, and the Ran understands it therefore, that Moshe is not giving them tochacha, he's not giving them rebuke in that particular statement, he is giving them comforts and strength to be able to withstand the challenge. And again, it goes back to our discussion of anava. The person has to be aware of their flaws, because otherwise, how do you correct yourself? But that must be accompanied with an awareness of one's greatness. I also want to point out, some of these are technical issues, but what time do you have? Okay. All right, I'll
listen. Yeah. Okay.
No, I'm all right. Or judgment, meaning you must treat rich and poor equally. And as Rav Abel points out, a king is a judge of his internal subjects, and a king runs Muhammad. Okay, maybe we'll step back. I just want to summarize.
With Moshe Rabbeinu, there's also a point that we have the leaders that we deserve.
Yes.
When the people are not on a high enough level that they can function with someone like Moshe Rabbeinu, they lose him, but that is to their detriment.
Mm-hmm.
The whole entering as Israel would have been different had we had Moshe to lead us. So it's a
It's very complicated. In fact, you're 100% correct. Although the Torah does indicate that Moshe did not enter the land of Israel because of his sin, it's also very, very clear that that was kind of the excuse that God needed, that the Jewish people, in fact, were not capable of having that leadership with Moshe. It was kind of like an empty nest syndrome. A child reaches a certain level of maturity, there's a different type of leader that they need, both in terms of what they need and in terms of what they deserve. Let me just say this. We have to decide whether we should have a class next week or not. Is there any particular consensus? I'm willing to let it go because of Chol HaMoed. So
I won't be here.
Okay, so maybe we'll take off next week. We'll make it up. Now, in terms of what you should look at, I do want to go over. We just began the Ikarim. I want to go over this passage of the Ikarim. Read it very, very carefully. In particular, the most important parts for our purposes are his very, very interesting discussion of the sin of Moshe Rabbeinu. This is a question all the commentators ask, right? Moshe Rabbeinu was supposed to do something with the rock, and he did something else. And God, out of the blue, says, you're not going to Israel. What was Moshe's sin? Now, it's interesting. Almost everybody says, well, the sin was he hit the rock instead of speaking to the rock. But you know, that's a very common mistake. That's what Rashi says. The Chumash itself is much less clear. And there are many interpretations. Some commentaries quote as many as 12 interpretations. Other commentaries list 36 or up to 50 interpretations. I believe that Kasuto, very prominent modern Bible scholar, who wrote commentaries, actually didn't write anything on this, and he wrote a reason why. He says, listen, the Torah says Moshe only did one thing wrong. If the commentators can come up with 50 different things you did wrong, we're obviously making it much worse than it was. So he said, I'm not going to add to the list. But be it as it may, Rav Albo has a very, on one hand, he does follow Rashi, but he does add a strikingly original interpretation of what the sin of Moshe was. That's one thing to focus on. That's in chapter 22. And then chapter 26, Rav Albo deals with a very, very interesting question. Why was the sin of David and Bathsheba forgiven with tshuva, and the malchut remained with David, but the sin of Saul against not killing Amalek was not forgiven, and Saul was not given a second chance? So he makes some very, very important distinctions between Shaul and David. And if you remember, I once gave a talk on Monica Lewinsky and President Clinton. I won't hold you, you don't have to remember that talk, but basically my conclusions were in fact drawn from this passage in the Sefer Ikrim. So now you know the passage, so we'll talk about that. But those are the two things. Now, again, one thing you'll notice is that this is far afield from abstract philosophy, and this is really just a fascinating example of Rav Albo's preaching ability and his desire to explain biblical passages, which, as I say, was a great reason with the book's popularity among rabbinic audiences, because he kind of explicates these very familiar texts. That's one thing. Now, another thing to look at, which we may begin next 2 weeks from now, although we may not finish, is in the anthology that you have, just read the introductory chapter. That's page 13. In fact, there's a lot of stuff from Rav Albo there to around 74. You can look at it very quickly. That basically deals with the idea that really is Maimonides' 13 principles, which we should know, and it deals with Albo's refutation, as I mentioned today, of whether there are 13 principles or only three, and the rest are shurashim, right? So that's simply the excerpt about that. Okay, so we probably will not finish that, but we may get to that. Okay, so have a very yeah. Yeah, this whole thing, plus the introduction in the book. Okay, have a good Sukkot and a good holiday, and we'll see you after the yeah.